everybody. My name's Sandy Beach. I'm an alcoholic. It's a pleasure to be here and to find such an enthusiastic pocket of, as Clancy used to call them, pockets of enthusiasm. It's not that way everywhere. There are some of us who think that sobriety should be a grim and serious affair. And those are good areas to move away from. And find an area of a little pocket of enthusiasm. And it's obvious that that's what you guys got out here. And I'm really delighted to be here. My friend Mike came along as a co-pilot, otherwise I'd still... Anyway, I like your name, Fourth Dimension. I don't know if I've ever run into a Fourth Dimension group. I think it's a great name. And of course, it comes out of our big book. And I'm sure in this group that people have talked about what it means, but I'll tell you what I think it means. I think it means the ability to see beyond where you saw before and to see things you didn't know existed and to fulfill your dreams with, as Chuck Chamberlain said, a new pair of glasses where you see the world and you see everybody in it almost the way God sees it. And then you start seeing that you really are just one of his kids. And that all the people in the room are your brothers and sisters, and you feel at home. It's a great vision. Nobody can stay there all the time. Bill talks about glimpses, but I mean, just a glimpse is pretty good. Yeah. And Chuck used to talk about a new pair of glasses. And I got to meet Chuck Chamberlain out on the West Coast and went to his house and I would sit there and listen to him talk, and he just went on and on. You knew that it was the most spiritual stuff in the world. And then I'd leave and I wouldn't have a clue what he was talking about. But I knew it was good. And I'm sure sometimes when we're new, we're wondering why people are so excited. Somebody goes, well, I just got fired, but I'm still happy. And doesn't make sense. The other thing I just wanted to mention, I don't know why I feel like talking about a couple little things, was our second tradition. We read the traditions tonight. For our group purposes, there's only one ultimate authority of loving God. Now, a lot of you that are new, you probably aren't aware of one of the important aspects of that tradition. And it occurred in 1950 when Dr. Bob died, and Bill suddenly realized that he and Dr. Bob were mortal and weren't going to be able to be in charge of AA forever, and that provisions had better be made for passing on the mantle and passing on whatever you want to call it, the leadership. And he thought long and hard about it, and he ended up turning it over to the second tradition. A lot of people think they turned it over to the delegates and the trustees, but he really turned it over to the ultimate authority, the loving God as he may express himself in our groups, and then the groups express themselves GSRs, and so on down. So the whole design of the entire service structure was to have God in charge. I think that's brilliant. I think that's just wonderful that we have a society this big, 75 years old, all over the world, and no one is in charge. It's almost impossible that something like that, and I'm sure sociology students and professors are look at AA and try to understand what holds it together. What would hold something together that has no one in charge? And I hate to tell them the answer, but it's alcohol. That's the glue that holds it together.
Okay.
realization that it's patrolling the grounds out there, waiting for someone to say, I'm fed up with AA, and then a pint of whiskey appears in front of you, and you think it's God's will. And then alcohol says, I'm going to beat you up until you go to AA and go along with what they're doing. And after a while, we come back in and go, okay, I'll behave myself and I'll follow what's going on, and I'm going to get on the same path that you're on. So we don't have people that are forcing us and all of that. We don't need to. The discipline comes from the fatal nature of our disease. And I was talking about this at the noon meeting. The fatal nature of the disease is, again, for those of you that are new, it's kind of an innocuous little part of our illness. And we're familiar with the fact that you keep drinking and you get sick and your body is being ruined, and your whole life is being ruined, and that punishment is one part of the disease. But there's a lot of things that might punish it, an allergy to strawberries or various things, some food allergy, and you don't know what it is. You know, sometimes when you're out eating, you get so sick you have to go to the hospital for a week, and eventually they diagnose what it is, and it's strawberries. And for the rest of your life, you don't eat strawberries, because it could kill you. You don't go to meetings of Strawberries Anonymous. Ask other people how they stay away. You just know that it kills you, it makes you sick, and you just don't do it. Well, when we get down the bottom of the line in our sickness with alcoholism, we get really sick, and we may end up going to a doctor, we may end up in a treatment center. And when we get in there, they explain the disease, and then we go, whoa, I'm an alcoholic. If I drink, it's going to kill me. And we accept that in our soul, that I'm an alcoholic. And if I drink, it'll kill me. That's absolutely useless in staying sober. Because in spite of that, you will always go back and take another drink. That's why we die. Having had everything explained, and our big book says we have no defense against the first drink. So the real killing part of the disease takes place when we're sober. That's when we kill ourselves. We just walk in, moment of insanity, 6 months sobriety, 2 years, whatever it is. Think I'll have a beer today. And bam. The one thing that'll protect us from that is God. And that's why the whole book is designed to focus us on having that protection, that spiritual protection against temporary insanity, which is what that would be, to go back out when you know it's going to kill you. But we do it all the time. And we somehow rationalize, as Clancy said, this time it'll be different. I'll just have 2 beers and quit. And so I'd just like to mention that is the part that causes us to die, is the insane thinking. Anyway, I came into AA December 7th of 1964, up in Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia. And I'm one of the ones that just picked up one white chip and stayed here. And a lot of us did that back then. I mean, maybe it's just my memory is going bad. But I think I had about 3 or 4 months before I heard about a slip in another group somewhere. And I asked my sponsor, I said, what's a slip? He said, you're not allowed to have one. So, but I was still curious, so I asked somebody else what it was. And I said, they went back to drinking. And so any time the thought of going back to drinking entered my mind, I realized that I wasn't allowed to do that. So maybe that saved me. I don't know. But I had the same sponsor for 42 years.
Wow.
And he was a wonderful guy, another Marine, Bill Terwilliger.
And we had a great run together, and when he was getting close to dying, we talked about what a journey the two of us had. Anybody who has a sponsor that long really has a new friend. I mean, that is a close bond. And I'm very privileged that that was the case with me. And of course, back in those days, you didn't call up AA and find out where a meeting was. You called up AA and they sent somebody over. The good old days. You didn't have to find a sponsor. They came to you. And in other words, the inner group called them, and when I called, God, I was in bad shape. I was an outpatient from a nut ward, and I was due back Monday, and I had started drinking over the weekend, and they had told me that if I ever drank again, my Marine Corps career was over. And they talked about AA, so I had this plan. I'll join AA. Then if they catch me, I'll tell them I joined AA and it screwed my life up when I started drinking, so it wasn't my fault. I was going to blame AA for the drinking. And I called up the inner group, and it was a Sunday, these Pearl Harbor Day. And they said, well, there's one other sober Marine. There was only one guy in AA in the whole Quantico Marine base. And that was Bill. And now, by the time he got over, I changed my mind. Now you have another drink, stay down. And then you... So I called the inner group back, and I said, cancel the call. I don't need any help after all. He said, he's on his way. He had no cell phone, so they couldn't call him off. So he came. And he took one look at me, and he just went inside. I was standing outside babbling away about something. And he asked all my kids. I had six kids and my wife. And they all agreed I was a perfectly rotten father. So he came back out and said, get in the car. And we're on our way to a meeting. And that was how I got there. I was probably sober 2 hours when I got to the meeting. It was a group anniversary, Manassas group. They celebrated all those things, and then they had turkey and ham and all the spread. Then they had a square dance. They had fiddle players. This thing was going on for 4 hours. So now I'm sober 6 hours. I'm not agreeing with people that are saying, isn't sobriety wonderful? And I wanted to get out of there, and it was a dumpy old Oddfellows Hall, and there was no street lights. It was winter time, and I was standing on the porch out in front, and I was going to make a break for it. I didn't know where to go. I felt this hand on my shoulder. It was an Al-Anon lady named Betsy Lynch. And I turned around, and she said, come on back in. It's going to be all right. And I believed her. It was like an angel came out and just went, peace, come on in. And so I went back in, and I haven't left since. Now, just briefly about my drinking, in case you think I'm faking it. I grew up, because obviously don't look like alcohol damaged me at all. So anyway, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut. I was born in 31. The big event of my life was World War II, as it was for anybody that grew up in that era. And I had one sister. She has 32 years in AA. And my mother and father. And we would sit at the table, and there would be the three of them and me. It was like I didn't even belong to that family. That's how I felt. It was, yeah, I see them, they're all relating, and then I'm over here. So even at that early age, I had the power to see myself as separate from everything around me. And I kept that up. The only two things I've ever joined is the Marine Corps and AA. Everywhere else, I was over here, and everybody else was over there. I had polio as a kid, and I recovered from that, and then I got into school, and I did very well, and my father sent me to a little prep school, and I got very high grades, good athletics, and on the outside, it looks like things are going great. We were brought up in the Catholic Church. My sister still goes. She thinks it's the most friendly, wonderful place. She'd been comforted there for her whole life. I, on the other hand, did not see it that way. I thought it was the scariest place I had ever been, ever. The Latin and the incense, and then going into that confessional, and I knew what they were doing. They were gathering evidence for later on. So you see, I'm very suspicious and frightened, and I'm just looking around. Everything is intimidating me, so I got no comfort from it. Not the church's fault, it's just how I happen to see it. You know, like Clancy said, everything is perception. There isn't anything except perception. And mine was that it was a very frightening place, and God was, something to be afraid of. My sister felt great comfort and still does. So there's the... For a number of years in AA, I used to blame the Catholic Church for becoming an alcoholic. And they asked me to stop, so I said, I stopped blaming anybody. And I'm convinced that it just happened. And it's probably that's the way God wanted it. Otherwise, he couldn't have put this society together, which is one of the most spiritual societies on planet Earth. Is Alcoholics Anonymous. It is the envy of a lot of spiritual organizations. I've had many ministers say, I wish my congregation was as interested in spirituality as you are, willing to really sacrifice for spiritual growth. And we go, we are not a typical congregation. The reason our success rate is so high is everyone who comes in is already desperate. And if everybody's desperate, your chances of success is a lot higher. They're going to listen to you when the less desperate are bored to death. In any event, all I had was sort of this nervous thing inside that I didn't fit in and didn't belong, but I could hide it. And I was accepted, the local college was Yale, and I was accepted in there. And I had worked on their buildings, I had been in construction, I knew the place, it was right downtown. But when I went there as a student, I suddenly realized, all these guys coming in are rich, and I knew some of them from newspapers, and I said, what am I doing in here? I work on the buildings, I don't belong inside. And I just could not hardly have a conversation with any of these people. I felt so inadequate. And so I had been there about 2 months, and my roommates are going, we drink in college, what are you doing? You're not drinking. I said, not yet, not yet. I want to get my high grades and try out for the track team and all that. But I'll tell you, the pressure got so bad, I was at an event one night where I was supposed to introduce myself to 20 or 30 guys. And I looked around, no one wanted to know me. They made it clear, I would just look, maybe I go, no. I really wasn't coming over there. And then these guys did the same thing, so I realized no one wanted me to come over to their group. So I didn't go anywhere. And there was a bar there, so I went over and said, well, maybe I'll see what this is all about. And I think I had 2.5 drinks, talking to the bartender, and I concluded that it didn't work. Because I didn't feel anything. I didn't feel any different. I just said, well, another lost experiment. And I turned around to leave, and everyone in the room wanted to know me. They were all looking at me, begging me to come. They almost were going, please, where to start? And as I started over to whichever group I chose, on my way over, I realized they would be lucky to know me. So I ran over. Hi, I'm so-and-so. Aren't you lucky to know me? Let me talk about this and that. I intuitively knew how to carry on conversation. It's almost like the real me, which was hidden inside of fear and anxiety, is now out. And he's free to be himself. And I knew all kinds of jokes. That was just amazing. And I kept it up, and pretty soon they're leaving. I go, where are you guys going? Does that sound familiar? You know. So they all left. And I went back to the bar, and I said, my God, if 3 drinks did that, what would 20 drinks do? So I got all the experimenting done that night. I just drank until I could barely walk. I went back, and of course, I got sick all night, sleeping on the bathroom floor. You know what I'm talking about. The room is spinning, and God, in the morning, I just sat there. I don't know when I've ever felt that bad. And the thought occurred to me, you going to drink again tonight? And I went, yes. I said, this dry heaving, puking feeling like you're going to die is a small price to pay for whatever happened last night. And that's why I'm an alcoholic. Because alcohol does things for me that are worth dying for. And alcohol does not do those things for social drinkers. It just makes them happy. It lets them have a nice time. It is not the secret of life. This solved every problem I ever had. As far as I was concerned, I didn't need anything except access to alcohol, and I had the rest of life figured out. I didn't know that. I thought it was just like another kid there. But it didn't take long. There goes the high grades. No athletics. Cops. Trouble. Maybe get thrown out. You know, those kind of things. And somehow I made it through the 4 years. And the Korean War draft was still on. Everybody had to join the military. So 4 of us, 5, I forget. Somebody said, let's go down and enlist in the Marine Corps. I said, well, let me finish my beer. That's a good idea. So we went down. I'm sure that recruiting sergeant just went, oh, this is perfect. Signed us all up. For those of you that have gone in the military, you know the shock when you arrive. But after that was over, I started loving being part of something. First time I was ever part of something. They really break you down so that you aren't anything, but yes, you're part of something. And then you become a Marine. And so I went through that, and then I went through 6 months training to be a platoon leader. And while I was there, I saw training movies about pilots. And they've been in the plane, but these guys were not sleeping in foxholes. They were at a club with scarves on, talking. There was some blonde standing in the background. I think I'll check this pilot thing out. So I went over, and the major said, well, you got to sign up for 3 more years. I said, that's all right, I'm not doing anything. If you want to stump me, come up after the meeting and ask me what I want to be when I grow up. I don't know, I haven't got a clue. And I didn't know them, and I still don't. And so I ended up, met a lovely woman, we got married, and I'm off to flight school, Pensacola, Florida. And back in those days, we had the old prop planes and went to Atlanta. Can't get here without going through Atlanta. And I got airsick on United DC-3. Airsick down in Pensacola. It looked like I wasn't going to be a pilot very long. But the motion sickness went away, and then I started doing great. I would be number 2 or 3 or 4 as we went through the 18 months of, you know, formation flying and gunnery and bombing and the carrier and night flight, all that stuff. And I get through advanced training in Texas, and then I get my wings, and now I'm off to El Toro for Marine Corps fighter training, and then overseas, and the war's over. So I'm over in Japan, and I'm flying hot dog airplanes, with a wonderful group of guys, and we're flying and working hard and drinking every night. I thought I had died and gone to heaven. It was just that wonderful. And about, and I thought I'd just fit in just like everybody else. Everybody seemed to like me, and I never had anybody say anything. I got in trouble here and there, but other guys got in trouble, so I didn't stand out that much. But probably about the ninth month, I was on the end of the runway with the maintenance officer, watching our guys practice for carrier landings. And he said to me, you know, in about a year and a half, I'm going to get promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. I can have my own fighter squadron, and I'm going to get nothing but the best pilots, and I want you. I'm a young lieutenant. And I go, whoa. I mean, geez, that was just wonderful. Then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. Now, this is a guy that I drink with all the time. He's saying to me, I wouldn't let you drink. I didn't ask him why. I knew better than that. I just pretended I didn't hear him. We're going to let that one go. And wasn't until I got to AA that I realized, in the middle of pretty heavy drinkers, my drinking scared them. I was doing something beyond what they were doing. The intensity with which I drank, you know, probably when I was sick, I was still drinking just like them, or whatever it was, that he spotted it. Anyway, I kept up my career for 14 more years. I had some wonderful assignments. We ended up having 6 children. And on the outside, you would say, look at this guy. He's been with the 1st Marine Division. He's done this. Now he's a flight instructor. Now he's in the photo squadron, Cherry Point, during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And you would just say, God, that guy's just doing great. But on the inside, alcohol was taking a heavy toll. And I was starting to experience withdrawal symptoms in the airplane. Withdrawals were coming, which requires daily drinking if you're going to stay alive. And of course, you can't drink for 8 hours. So I wouldn't drink, and then I'd go out to the plane, and then I'd have horrible things happen while I was flying. I would feel like I'm going to lose consciousness. My breath would go. My heart was racing. I'm sweating. My vision is getting clouded over. So it was really frightening to go fly because there's only one guy in the airplane. But I didn't know anything about AA. There's no such thing as an alcohol program. Just, you're on your own. So I said, well, I just have to make the best of it. So I just kept showing up. But I would climb up in that plane and I'd go, oh, please. Sometimes it'd be all right, and other times it'd be a nightmare. And there were, I remember flying sometimes with one hand on the ejection seat, and the stick had all the photo controls, so you could fly the mission with one hand. And my theory was, if I did pass out, that I could fire the seat and I would be ejected. Chute opens automatically at 10,000, the plane crashes, problem solved. I was almost proud of myself for solving a problem that I had. And that's the insanity, is to think that that's a solution. Flying a plane while you're passing out. Anyway, the end came when I just had a tremendous attack of something in the airplane and I had to get out. I don't know if you've ever been anywhere when you were drinking, you had to leave that second. I'm sorry, come on. You're at a wedding, you're getting a haircut, you know, whatever it is. And they go, well, where are you going? I'm leaving, I can't stay here. Remember that? You couldn't even stay in your own skin. I was going wacky. And on this flight, it was that we had 2 airplanes, and this one was an easy one to fly, but it was 2 people, the radar guy over here and the pilot. And there was 4 of us on a cross country. I don't remember where we had been. I was a number 3 man, and I said, I gotta get out of this plane now. I thought maybe having a heart attack, I don't know what. And I realized, this guy doesn't know how to fly. I can't jump out. So I declared a fuel emergency, an oxygen emergency. When you have that, the flight leader has to find a place to land immediately, because if you have bad oxygen, you might pass out from that. So we spot an airport base, we land. I go in, I get a couple drinks, whew, I feel a little better, and all of that. And the next morning, they didn't find any oxygen problem. And I told the flight leader, I'm not going to do this anymore. And this is who I am, this is my whole life. And alcohol just said, you're all through flying, buddy. Tell them. So I said, I'm not going to do this anymore. Why? I would not say why. I just said, I'm just not going to do it. He said, well, you're going to have to talk to the colonel. So somebody else flew back, and I went to see the colonel. He said, Sandy, what are you talking about? I said, I'm not going to fly anymore, colonel. That's it? Yes. Decision's final? Yes. I said, okay, well, we're going to tell headquarters Marine Corps to give you a new assignment. It took about 3 months. Believe it or not, they made me an air traffic controller. That didn't last long. My whole career was over shortly after that. But I had 3 months to wait, and I was so ashamed I couldn't look any of the other guys in the eye. And I did the legal work, and I would just be in there, and I could feel them walking around, looking in, going, what a piece of crap. How did he get in our outfit? It was just that, you ever feel that shame? You can't make eye contact with anybody. But God walks in and just quits flying. What kind of a, oh man, that's a green home. So I just felt, ugh. And a couple of years ago, I was out in L.A. at the Brentwood Group, and I've told this quite a bit recently. And a lady was coming to get her 30-year medallion, and her husband was driving her. He's not an alcoholic, but he goes to AA with her a lot. But that night, he was going to have a cup of coffee while she got her 30-year medallion, and I was giving a talk at the Brentwood Group. And she mentioned my name to him, and he said, was he a pilot? And she said, oh, yeah. I said, I think I know him. Tell him to come out here. Let me talk to him. So I went out. Never saw this guy in my life. And he said, you know, in 1962, you were in the flight of 4 F3D radar planes. You declared an oxygen emergency, and all the planes landed. And you never flew again. That's kind of personal knowledge. For someone to know. And I said, how did you know that? He said, I was in the plane with you. Turns out he wasn't a radar guy, he was another pilot. And he had been recalled from American Airlines for the Cuban Missile Crisis. And the planes were gone from Cherry Point because there was a hurricane coming. And when you do hurricane evacuations, the pilots fly somewhere safe and drink until the hurricane leaves, and it's safe to bring the planes back. And so there wasn't any radar guys going on that one. It was going to be all pilots. So anyway, we got talking, and the next day he came to a conference I was speaking at, and he brought a bunch of photographs. Yeah, you remember? And then I said, oh yeah, I remember the colonel and all this. I didn't have any, I didn't save anything. And then he said, did you know how popular you were in that squadron? It broke our hearts that you were leaving. The colonel went crazy. He called all over the place to find something to help you. And we couldn't figure anything out. He said, I can't tell you how sad we were when you left. And I said to myself, well, that's not how I remember it. So I concluded that he was right, and I was wrong. So I went back 42 years ago and changed my past. Anybody think you could change your past? We do it all the time. We get rid of old ideas. My ideas were that they didn't like me, and they were little, and they were all that. I found out they were sad that I was leaving. They were very supportive. So I filled in those memories. Now, whenever I think of that, I go, boy, that was nice, the way those guys treated me. That's a nice memory to have. And it used to be a horrible memory to have. And there's a big lesson there. Very important spiritual lesson that the ideas that you have are probably wrong. So let's put them all on the table Let other people help us look at them and see which ones you want to throw away and which ones you want to replace with the truth. And when we do that, we're well on our way to a spiritual awakening, because we're getting rid of the things that are blocking us from seeing who we really are and how we really fit in. So anyway, I did make it through air traffic control school and had one nightmare year overseas running a radar unit with a tower and all that stuff. And God, as soon as I got there, the enlisted men who run the whole show took one look at me and they said, "Captain, it's great to have you here. Here's your tent, pumped around, here's your cup of coffee. Captain, don't you personally talk to any airplanes." Okay. Because I was so shaky, I could have run two planes together. So somehow I survived that, but I was back at Quantico, which I was talking about earlier, which is where I was when my sponsor came. And I had a grand mal seizure going to school there, and I was sent up to the hospital to see what caused it. And even up there, no one would thought of alcohol. They just thought it was overworked, bad diet, or something like that. It was amazing how ignorant it was about alcoholism. So I was up in the nice part of the hospital with all the nice people, and I started getting the DTs and hallucinating. And I saw a lot of strange things. People were chasing me. And I guess I went berserk and ran around, and they put me in a straitjacket and locked me up in the nut ward for 6 months. And so that was where alcohol took me. And somehow, out of that mess, I found my way to AA, got sober, lost my career. We had to start all over with the six kids and all that, and I'm not a very good breadwinner. Some guys are real good at earning money. I'm just terrible. So we were I'd hate to tell it to any of you new guys how long it was before I was financially even. Because you'd probably get up and walk out of the room. But it was a lot of years, probably 15. You know, where if the battery died, you have to wait till payday to buy another one, you know, those kind of things. Oops, the electricity's off for one day. But we still had a lot of fun. And eventually, after I was thrown out, I had several different jobs, and I ended up with a great career up in D.C. And I retired down to Tampa 15 years ago. I've been down here, and I love Tampa, Florida, just like you love Newport, Richie. Just every time I fly back in, I just thank God. A friend of mine came down here to work, and he kept talking me into coming here, and I'm so glad he did. I love the AA, I love all the people, and it's just been marvelous. And the biggest thing I love is the spiritual path that I was placed on and guided along, because it has changed everything in terms of my relationship with myself, with other people, and most of all with God. I didn't want anything to do with God when I got here. I told you my childhood stuff. I don't want to hear the word. I think I went 5 years saying higher power. I would not let the word God come out of my dear higher power. Please take care of me that way. How much pride do you need? And I think at the end of 5 years, I said, you know, you can say God faster than higher power. So, purely for efficiency, I switched over. And that's the most important word in the big book, as far as I'm concerned. It is just how they put this together so we each can have our own understanding of this, of our Creator. And nobody tries to put their interpretation on top of the other person. We're all just completely free to have this understanding. And it has just been amazing. And I had a couple things last year. I had one daughter murdered, and another daughter 3 months later died of alcoholism. And that'll put God to the test. And so I'm not going to go into, any great detail, but I'm going to tell you a story about a lady up in Washington, D.C. that I saw on television probably 30 years ago. And it was one of these local news things, and her son had just been murdered. He was a black kid, a student in high school. He was in the wrong neighborhood, and some kid with drugs or something just killed him for no real reason. And the reporters found this mother that afternoon and jammed a microphone in her face and said, "How do you feel about the kid that killed your son?" And she said, "I've already forgiven him." I couldn't believe my ears, but I looked at her face. She was at peace. She had already forgiven him. And then I remember about 8 or 9 years later, the Amish did the same thing. Remember that, when the kid murdered, and the parents of the kid who was murdered went over to see if they could comfort the parents of the boy that did the killing. Those are powerful examples. And I remember just sitting there looking. I said, "I didn't know you could do that.
Wow.
I didn't know you could forgive the same day." Now, why I didn't think you could, I thought there was a minimum sentence that you had to endure, and then you could eventually forgive.
Yeah.
You know, you want to forgive, yeah, but not yet.
Yeah.
Well, what are you going to do in the meantime? Suffer and hate. Suffer and hate. So I used to talk about this with my friends. I said, "I still remember that lady." I said, "That's the most amazing story." And when my daughter called me and said, "Are you sitting down? I'm going to tell you this. Barbara was murdered this morning." And then she started in on the details. Before she finished, whoever had done it was forgiven. And that's all I can report to you. So the only thing, the reason I tell you that is, when you do that, and maybe after hearing it here, you will remember it. When you do that, the only suffering you have to do is sorrow. There's no hatred, there's no resentment, and there's no anger. So, and God will help you with suffering, but He won't help you with hatred.
No.
And He won't help you with anger. But He will help you with suffering. And so it just was amazing. And then 3 months later, when my other daughter died of alcoholism, the same daughter called me. She's the hero of the family. She's taking care of the other. She's in AA, and the girl that was murdered was in AA, and we should have had the third one in. And when she called me up, I knew she was getting close. So I'd already thought it through because I read it somewhere. And when I found out, when you get news, bad news or whatever it is, there is a small period of time before you react to it. Sometimes you walk over to the couch and then sit down and then go, "Okay, I'm going to let it in now." So there is that little period of time. I used that period of time to go to God and tell Him, "This is not going to change how I feel about you. You come ahead of everything. I'm just going to stay here for a couple of minutes, tell you how much I love you, and that no matter what it is, it's not going to change how I feel about you." And it probably took about 2 minutes, and then I went over to sit down and take it all in, and guess who came with me? And sat down with me. And help me look at it, and help me react to it, and all of that. So, the lesson out of all of this is to apply the principles now. In the instant, in the moment. You know, we talk about living in the now. That's really where it pays off. Is to accept right now. You get fired. Okay, I accept it. I'm not going to say it's unfair. I'm not going to anything like that. Okay, so now I'm looking for a job. Do you see what I'm saying? Instead of, "Well, it'll take me about a month to get used to it and accept it and to complain," I better put it in a month. Every meeting I go to, I just said, "I got 5 minutes." I can't believe it. They promote the other guy and I got 5 minutes. And God is unfair, so now He's off our team. And so I owe all this to teachers that I saw. I saw it with my own eyes, and it was amazingly powerful. So I just passed that on. So we're running out of time, and I want to say a few words to the newcomers. Obviously, you're very lucky to be in this group. That's the environment that you're in is crucial to your happiness. Anybody can get sober. Getting sober is not what AA is about. You want to get sober? Punch a cop. Our target in here is much higher than that. Anybody who's settling for water wagon sobriety is missing the point of this whole show. The point is to have this transformation, this profound personality change. And very often people will see it in you before you see it coming. And they'll just look at it and go, you know, look at Jane. It's starting to hit her, isn't it? And she sees her. I love to watch women come in and they get beautiful again. Their whole inner beauty comes out and then it just radiates. And when they first get here, it's the saddest thing in the world. Looking at guys that look like him. But it's just so sad to see women who were radiant, beautiful mothers or whatever, and they just look like awful. And this spirituality comes in and it just starts doing magic. And if people don't know we're in AA, they'll go, are you on a diet? What are you doing? We're in some kind of a youth program or something. Looking younger and eyes sparkling and a positive outlook instead of complaining all the time. This is the earmarks of a spiritual awakening. These are things that don't come from therapy. These are magic. And that's what God does. I like to look at our promises. Just look at the words that are in there. Self-seeking will slip away. Slip away? What the hell kind of a term is that? Fear of people and that kind of will leave us? Can you imagine going to a psychiatrist? Don't worry, it'll leave you. I mean, all the verbs in there are magic verbs. They're verbs that a magician would use. And the magician is God. So really, when it says, are these extravagant promises, we should say, you certainly are. But they're not extravagant because God doesn't. They're remarkable. And then comes the moment. If you look for a nice sentence where it might describe a spiritual awakening, there it is. We suddenly realize that God is doing for us. So these things have been changing. We can feel ourselves getting a little happier. We're more comfortable in our home group. And we're going, wow, wow, this is really cool. And then comes the jackpot. We suddenly realize, that's God. I just felt God. And we are aware that all these gifts aren't coincidences, but they were caused by this word God that everybody's talking about. And when that transformation happens, we have to attribute it to something. It certainly wasn't a human event. And most of us choose the word God to describe the experience we just had. Up until then, it's just a word. It really doesn't have any meaning until you have this experience. Now, we know that other people have had it, and they speak of God as what transformed them. And so when it happens to us, the word itself becomes God. It suddenly goes from a three-letter word to a profound personal experience. That, if you're new, is what you don't want to miss. So even if you're resisting this whole spiritual thing, I don't want to be part of this, that's fine. Just keep an open mind, let your sponsor move you along. That's all right, don't worry about that now, just come on. Let's start an inventory, and we gently get herded along until it happens. And when it does happen, you can't resist wanting to pass it on. It's so wonderful. And I think that's what happened to Bill Wilson. When he had that spiritual awakening, there were two things that happened. I call it the Big Bang of AA. Because in that instant, every alcoholic in the world, there was hope for him. Prior to that instant, there was no hope for any alcoholic. And so that marvelous spiritual sudden transformation not only removed the obsession to drink, but it put inside of Bill an irresistible urge to give it to every alcoholic in the world. And he could not stop himself. I mean, look at his first couple years. He had no money. He lived out of a borrowed car. He must have lived in 75 different homes in the first 2 years as he's trying to get AA started. That's a powerful inner force that is causing, and it's because he wants to make sure other alcoholics have an opportunity for that singular experience, the awareness of your own creator. And that's what's available here. A lot of people come in and settle for something less. I got no problem with that. But I would sure urge, if you're new, target for the big one. Go for the, what the hell, that's how you drank. Did you settle for half men? No, I think I'll go home. I don't think we did that. So I would go as far as you can in here, just as far as you went with drinking. And when you do, your enthusiasm will be contagious, and you'll be sitting down some new guy or gal, and they'll look at what's in your eyes, they'll listen to the words you're saying, and they're going to say to themselves, I want what she has. I want what he has. And that's the greatest gift. Your horrible past is how you're going to transform these people. That they will listen to you, whereas they won't listen to some professor or some judge or some doctor. They'll listen to somebody else who was in the same hell they were in, and now they're out. And they want to grab your hand and say, I know how to get you out of there. Come on. So take their hand and celebrate. Thank you all very much.